Okay, we're back on.
So, I think, Chris, unless you were asking me, has anybody raised any questions about your pricing relative to others and stuff? And so, and especially relative to GS, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly, you know, Tim Ryan at PwC especially was saying, you know, why is Goldman here and you here, right? And through all of this period, right, of probably from about October, mid-October maybe, to, you know, February, Tim was always sort of, well, what about Goldman, right? And it, and so, you know.
Stop, he's coming.
Pardon me?
Stop, he's coming.
Well, so at one point during this period, right, and I can't really remember exactly the exact date, but I think it was sometime in November. I said, what is it with Tim and these Goldman prices, right? And talking to Henry, who, right, and you know the chronology, right? Tim's the partner, engagement partner at AI, for AIG, and Henry is the FP engagement partner, and my relationship with Henry was pretty good at this time. And I, you know, and he said, look, how did he explain it to me? Tim is like a dog with a bone, and he's just going to keep gnawing at this. I said, but why does he hold Goldman in such high esteem? You know, because I think I'm explaining fairly well why there's the differences, right? And that no one institution has it right. Just fast forward a bit, and maybe this encapsulates. December 18th, he comes to my office in London, and we have a meeting.
He being?
Tim Ryan, sorry. Comes to the office in London. We sit down and talk. And Tim raises very directly with me this issue of what about Goldman and so on. And he says, look, I'm going to go talk to Goldman myself. And I said, I want to talk to your counterparts and understand their pricing. And I said, what? You can't go and do that. You're going to undermine my negotiations with them. You walk into, my auditor walks into a room with the people that I'm negotiating with and says, I'm not so sure of his position. I'd like to understand what you're doing. He said, that's, you know, what are you doing? Right, you can't do that. Or I said, at least if you're going to do that, we're going to have to talk to my bosses, and I'm going to tell them that I don't think you should do this. Right, and I said, look, Tim, are there? And I offered up a variety of alternatives. And I said, look, you can audit this stuff to understand what's going on, but you're Goldman's the big PwC, you're Goldman's auditors. Can't you go and have a conversation with your partner on the other side, you know, sort of, what are they, you know, behind the screen, you know, off to the side conversation and say, so that you can get familiar with what they're doing. And you can, you know, and through that, you can validate some of the things I'm saying about the numbers and things. And he said, no, I've got to go talk to them directly. And I said, well, look, I can't, we've got to discuss this with others. This isn't, I don't think this is right. He then said, well, look, I have to, why do you have to do this? And it's good audit procedure, right? I said, well, if that's the case, since Goldman's in a cycle, they're a month ahead of us in the reporting cycle, how come they're not coming to me? How come I'm not having somebody from PwC on Goldman's account come and talk to me if this is the way audits are performed? And he said, look, I just think this is good audit, you know. And I said, well, I don't understand. If this is audit, you know, procedures, aren't they somewhat, quote, standardized in a way? Isn't, you know, that I should be seeing someone from the other side. So Tim and I, you know, the meeting ended and we were in disagreement on this issue. And so to answer your question, did anybody raise this about pricing and all that? Yes. PwC was raising it, and Tim Ryan especially was raising it about the difference between us and the Goldman prices. And I think that answers the question.
Well, was Tim Ryan saying, I believe Goldman's prices more than I believe yours?
Implicitly.
Okay, but not explicitly.
Right.
Okay. Did he go and talk to Goldman?
We went, for a long time, we went around this issue until this meeting I talked about in January, where again, he raised the issue that he wanted to talk to Goldman. I said, look, you can, you know, and we went, again, offered up a variety of scenarios. You, PwC, we'll have a conversation with Goldman about the collateral calls. You can be on the call, but I'd like you to be on the call unannounced. Right? You don't like that idea?
It sounds curious to me.
Well, the idea would be it wouldn't take away from my negotiating position with Goldman, right? That I needed to introduce my auditor. Why is your auditor on the call? Well,
then they would hear real time what was going on.
But they'd hear exactly everything that was going on. So there'd be, you know, and you can give us a list of questions and be on the phone. And we'll ask the questions. And, you know, you can be there and ask us to follow up and do all those good things. And it was, no, we need to be announced. We want to be on the phone and we want to be announced, right? Which is, I didn't think was going to serve anybody. And in this meeting, right, Steve's there, Steve Bensinger is there, Bill Dooley is there, Mike Romer is in this meeting also. So then I said, well, how about if we then have the all the, you know, management, the AIG people, on the call. And I said, look, Elias is former auditor. Elias is somebody that, you know, if you think, you know, because clearly the implication was I wasn't telling the full story or my team wasn't telling the full story. Elias is trusted. Have him on the call. And then it was like, well, that's good. We'll do that. But we also want others on the call. So we want Bob Lewis to be on the call. We want... and so anyway, we finally have this call. And it's...
Without PwC.
Without PwC, right? So they... But it's... I'm not on the call because I want to make sure that nobody thinks I'm influencing. And I'm not on many of these calls that we have with Goldman. And but it's my team along with, and I think, Mike Gromer, David Herzog, Bob Lewis, Elias Habieb was on, and I think there were others from AIG that were on to listen to the call. And, you know, and it's, and we, I think there's a, you must see this, there's a transcript out there in this call.
It's recorded.
Right.
This is a February call, right?
It's January 28th.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. Right. Okay. And I think so. We finally, and that seemed to solve the issue. But all this time, PwC never. Then finally, you know, they didn't.
That solved the issue of what PwC
see,
wanting
asking to be on the call, and they were never on the call.
Okay. So,
just to finish this point,
sure.
I raised this issue about PwC wanting to be on the call with. I think in January with my board, with the FP board, and I said, look, I'll do whatever you guys want, but I don't think this is a good idea. And I explained it to him, and they didn't think it was a good idea either.
Okay. Now, there's indications in PwC's work papers, in fact, more than indications, that they feel they're going to have a problem completing the audit as long as you're around. Do you recall any discussions about that, and one, and two, does that have anything to do with the retirement that gets announced on February 28th?
One, I don't know anything. It's funny, they never said that to me. So, no, I don't know about that. And my retirement is, you know, pretty straightforward. It's the week of the material weakness, which I guess all that discussion happened on Monday. That Friday, Martin calls me, asks to meet with me that Friday afternoon. I go to meet with him and Bill Dooley. Martin explains to me that, in light of everything, there's going to have to be changes. And he doesn't think that they're going to have to make changes in reporting lines. And he doesn't think I would be happy with the changes. And he suggests that I retire. And, you know, one of the things, you know, somebody suggests that you retire, say, okay, I'm going to retire. And that's the bit I know about my retirement.
Okay, other than the reporting changes, did he mention he was going to make any type of changes?
No.
Did he mention anything about changing the compensation system at FP?
No.
Okay. Do you know if the compensation system was changed at FP after you left? Or around the time you left?
Well, you know that I changed the compensation system in November, right? I mean...
I think so, but explain it to me. Shortly.
Okay. It's hard, right? But look, you know that I... Because of what was going on with the mark-to-market losses up until November, I wanted to make sure... There were two issues on my mind. One, we've got to keep the organization going, right? And there's this, you know, we need to keep... there's an awful lot here, right? We know about all the statistics, right? $100 billion of footings, $2.7 trillion of swaps, the $500 billion credit derivative book, you know, 400 people working around the globe and things. There's a lot of risk that needs to be well managed, right? So how are we going to deal with compensation going forward, right? AIG has already announced that they are not going to count the valuation adjustment, your words, right, in the calculation of FP's bonus pool, right? So, but my thinking is, wait, we've got to put ourselves in line with the shareholders and the company, right? These losses are real. And but we need to also keep the continuity of the company. So how do we do that? I thought about revising the current plan that we have, and you know how the current plan works. We're highly paid, you know, end up contributing 45% of what they make in any 1 year into the deferred compensation pool, and that's put at risk to the company in subordinated debt. But I thought we needed to do more, and so I suggested to Bill Dooley in a memo that you must have read that we revamp the compensation. And it was along the lines of what I have been seeing others do on the street, right? People needed some cash, right, to have their own personal cash flow for managing them. So pick a number of, I think in the number was nobody could get paid higher than $1,250,000. Everything else that they would have earned after that, so that, you know, it's $1,250,000, and then especially those people that were lower compensated in the ranks would be able to get their money. First, the regular deferred compensation pool would kick in, so that would mean no one would get more than sort of $950,000, I think the number was. Secondly, though, everything else above the $1,250,000 would go into a special incentive plan, right? So a pool of deferred comp. That money, my suggestion was that money stay there for 3 years, because I thought if there was going to be a crystallization event of any of these credit derivative multi-sector CDOs, it would happen by then. The company thought 5 years would be a better time, so we agreed on 5 years. It would sit in the company as a five-year bullet, right? So, and in that same memo, I suggested to Bill that I not get paid anything, and that I accept a handshake from these guys that says, if things work out the way I think they will, and these will pay off, then you guys can decide what my compensation should be, right? And
meaning no actual economic losses at the maturation of the contracts,
right? And, you know, and it was completely in their discretion. I was going to shake their hands and trust them on what this was. I did write in the letter to make sure the board knows that we're doing this, right? So going forward, the compensation committee accepts that plan, but they reject my offer to not take any compensation, and they say that they want me to be, when I asked Martin why they rejected my offer, he says they wanted you to be aligned with your colleagues, right? And so I did get paid SIPs, right? But as you know, clearly I lost all the money in the SIPs and plus my other deferreds, right, in this process. So that was one change to the compensation system, right? Martin never told me about a change that needed to be made to the compensation system. But after my announced retirement, I know that Bill Dooley did change the compensation system such that I think, do I have this right, did they guarantee all the employees for the next 2 years at what their compensation would have been, at the level of their compensation in 2007, but it was on a cash basis, using the old deferred plan, not the SIPs, right? So they weren't putting 100% into the company. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So okay. I want to make sure I heard you right. You're saying back in November of 07 is when you changed the plan? I should say, is when the plan was changed?
I proposed the change, right, in early November to Bill. Actually, the first time I raised it with him is on the airplane in the Investor Roadshow. We then sent him a memo in November, and I think the actual compensation committee meeting may have been in December of 07.
But part of that change, tell me if I'm correct, was now we're not going to include the unrealized valuation loss.
No, that was already something that was determined by AIG. Martin announced that earlier, that the valuation losses weren't going to be included in calculating the FP compensation pool.
Okay, and what's the timing of that?
We have the document. It's October.
It's 07, right?
Right. It's earlier. It's earlier than this, but it's in October.
Once, it's once there's indicators that there's losses coming. So explain, as you can probably imagine, what am I not understanding about that? Why is that change made? On the surface, it looks like something that makes you go, huh? Why are we not including that?
Talk to Martin.
No, you had a view on it.
Did you have discussions with anyone about what the thinking was for doing that?
Sorry, guys, I need to think. Look, I think what they all thought was the same thing I thought, that these losses weren't real, that these things were going to come back, and that this was just a valuation loss, right? And that they, remember the company was always in the same camp that I was on this. Bob Lewis, the risk manager, and Kevin McGinn, everyone thought these contracts are going to pay off, right? And that this was an aberration due to the need to mark these things to market.
Do you think that kind of change aligns the interests of management with shareholders?
Look, I thought my change aligned the interests of me and my colleagues with the shareholders. I was happier with mine, and that's why I suggested it, right?
But yours still would have included not including the unrealized valuation.
Yeah, but you didn't get any cash. You didn't get paid. You took all the money that they would. So take the formula which Martin was going to pay, excluding that, right? So Martin makes that decision. I say, wait a second. I think we need to be more committed to the shareholders. Let's take, and for all the highly compensated individuals, it's sort of like 95% of what they make, and put it at risk for the next 5 years to the corporation. So it's more than taking the valuation losses, right? It's taking everything, or 95%, and putting it at risk to the corporation, to whatever events are in the company, and it was, as I said, it was more. It was aligning the interests of me and my colleagues more greatly, or with the shareholders, than the future plan that was developed, where the cash was paid out over, where the offer was, we'll keep you guys around and we'll pay you for the next 2 years.
So just to be clear about this, let's just take a hypothetical. Let's just say that someone was going to get $100 worth of compensation, right, as a result of the accounting losses being excluded, right? Under the old plan, $55 of that they would have taken home, right? $45 that would have been in, right? Instead, they could only take out $5, and $95 was going to be deferred, and that was part of the capital base. So whenever we talk about whatever AIG lost, there's about $300 million
of it. Bigger than that.
It's bigger than that. $70 million of it, which is his, that the company didn't have to didn't have to absorb because of his plan. So
I understand.
Okay.
While you're CEO at FP, do you decide who gets how much bonus out of that bonus pool?
The way the plan works is I allocate out the bonuses, right? Mm. Obviously I tell my team how big the pool is, I tell the managers where we are, they allocate it to their, they come back with schedules allocating what they think people should get paid. I allocate what that group of direct reports are, what I think they should get paid. I then go and sit with, every year I would either sit with, over the years that I was CEO, either Mr. Greenberg and Mr. Matthews, or I would sit with Martin and Bill Dooley, and I would show them the distribution of the schedule, show them how I were paying people, and then they would look and they would decide what my compensation was, right? And then also in this mix, there's from our compensation pool, is where we get the return that we would pay as an equity kicker on the deferreds that are in the company. And so there was a play between whatever they decided, right, whatever was there.
But was it your call on who got paid what, or could they veto it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So
that's why I had to go.
Or Greenberg could say no.
It was an absolute consultation with them.
Okay. Did you guys have anything you wanted to ask?
The equity kicker, can you explain that very quickly?
No. I can explain it. It's just I have a quick. All right. So people would put their deferreds in. They would earn a LIBOR interest rate on that, right? But in order to, it was capital in the company. So how do you give them that kind of return that they should get as an equity component, right, as if it was capital? What we would do, our pool was, I think, right, we had a split of 70-30 after expenses. Out of the FP pool, 30%, I, with consultation, again, with management at AIG, and the approval of a committee of the board that was our board that was set up, I would create an equity kicker. So I would take a piece of our pool and then allocate it across the deferred contributions so that you got an economic lift for being at risk to the company during that period.
What was the purpose of that? To incentivize people to defer more than they had to?
Okay,
I just want to make sure I got it right.
Okay.
Then the two other questions. The compensation we have for folks in 2007, are all of the executives, everything they made over $1.25 million went into the deferred?
Should go into the SIPs. Unless, if somebody had a guarantee that was greater than the $1.25 million, yeah. So we hired a.
So if they were in the first 2 years,
right? They may have gotten more, right? And so you, and that maybe if you're looking like Tom Athen, maybe on that schedule, I don't know, right? And he.
But for Makatis or.
Yeah, Pierre, all the people you
Forster,
know,
all those folks,
Andy,
everything above 1.25 would have been deferred and
right.
lost.
It was lost when we when
so
the company was taken over.
Well, that was my other question. Is if. That was not clear to me. But so the deferred, the money that was subordinated was just lost entirely?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know if it was deferred yet again. Okay.
No, right. No, Stacey,
there's an 8K, not an 8K. In one of the, I think the 2008 10K makes it clear that everything that was in the deferred comp was wiped out.
You know, okay. And perfect. You know, we can be technical about this. The deferred comp has a, right, the what do they call it again, where you if FP ends up in the resolution, the final resolution of FP, if there's a dollar left,
right,
well. Right, right. No, I'm just saying that's
theoretically,
right. If there's a dollar left, that would be distributed to all the, proportionally across everybody in there. But the company sends out a schedule, right, what your share of what the losses are based mm-hmm. upon your contributions into it. Yeah, that's not happening. But just for your records, that's
so that supersedes the terms of your actual.
Yes. So now we're talking about this, the $1.25 million and the SIPs, but the previous plan was still in place, right? And it kicked in at $500,000, right? Where everything 10%, the first 50,000 I think got deferred to 10. So there's a deferral that goes on that $1.25 million also. That goes into the deferred pool that was also wiped out. So that's why I was saying the most I think anybody got was 950. The number may be 970, but that's
okay.
Okay.
I just have a couple of questions. The first is going back to what we were talking about sort of at the beginning of our meeting today about the development and growth of the multi-sector CDS book. If you could help us understand and put that book into perspective in terms of the overall business of the financial products group and how you as the CEO at FP were looking at that book and the development and the significant growth in that book from 2003, 2004, and then really in 2005, and just help us understand that vis-a-vis everything else that you were seeing and that was going on at FP at this time.
It was a segment of our business, right? When I would look at the business, I would look at it in its component parts and then also try and look at it in an integrative way, right? And the components were, as I've said before, commodities, credit, fixed income or interest rates, equities, and currencies, right? Along then with our structured finance business. The growth of the business, and I'd also, you look at sort of the risk and the profitability of the businesses, and here a business we were building was quite remote risk, right? And, you know, we can all talk about that some more if we want. But the view was we built a remote risk business. And it was paying us, you know, a marginal return for that risk that we had. But it was growing commensurate with the rest of the business. It wasn't, you know, and in fact, you know, the commodity business in some ways was growing faster during this period, right? It was a new business. We had,
yeah, I know. The answer is yes.
We were, you know, we were early movers in the idea that investing in an index basket of commodities would be a diversifying effect, like having a balanced portfolio of fixed income and equities. Now add commodities to this, and this diversification would give you greater protection. And we were, in fact, us and we were direct competitors with Goldman in this, and it was the, you know, the AIG index, and there was the Goldman Index.
Right. Right, there was just an article about that in Harper's this week.
There you go.
Right.
Not that Harper's is my magazine of choice.
Well, it wasn't very detailed, but yeah, I
Right. So, but there was that business. There was the, you know, the fixed income business, the interest rate business, was sort of like a bedrock of our institution, right? There was also the, you know, in the investment contract business. You know that we, over time, we had accumulated $64 billion of borrowings, and we were investing that, and that's part of where Jim was always saying, well, if you wanted to meet these cash flows, where would you get the cash from? And we had this investment pool that we had that we could liquidate and be able to meet the margin calls. And so I, you know, I would look at all of this in the aggregate, but it wasn't standing out as a significant growth. Also, if you look within the realm of the credit derivative, the super senior credit derivative business, you know, in many ways, the European business or the international business, the non-U.S. business, and, you know, you understand that there was a dichotomy where the Americans, the Federal Reserve here was allowing banks, if they had sold off the lower tranches of risk, to keep it if they proved to the Fed that their models were working, wherein the BIS said, no, you, if you really want to prove that you've sold it, go out and sell it, and you'll get the capital relief, right? So there was this dichotomy in the two systems.
And the notional of the European book is much larger.
Right, and it was growing, and that was growing much more rapidly than this. And, you know, at the same time that we were looking at other issues here, we were looking at are there issues there, but the mortgage markets are very different, right? The residential markets and the nature of those transactions. And that was the other thing, is that, you know, my guys, you know, Andy was looking and saying, no, you know, German loans and the idea of mortgages in Germany are different than what we're seeing developed. You know, it's interesting when you mentioned mid-prime, you know, this is what I was thinking about was in the UK they don't have a subprime market, but they do have this thing, very British kind of name called near-prime. Right, almost, right? And, you know, it was a market that we, you know, I think Andy said, you know, look, this isn't, this is like the subprime in the U.S. and we should stay away from this too, right? And I think, so I don't know if I'm answering your question as thoroughly as you may want, but I would look, try and look at the businesses in the aggregate, but this wasn't standing out as the biggest, hottest thing we were doing. It may be one of the bigger products that and commodities probably were the bigger products in North America. And structured finance, some of the structured finance business, but around the globe, no.
Yep. I think that, I mean, that gets to what I was looking for.
Thanks.
As I understand it, the other derivative businesses that FP was involved in were largely run as flat books, meaning that you had offsetting positions long and short, and but the credit book was not run in that way. And if you could just speak to that a little as to why.
Yeah. Look, I'm always uncomfortable when somebody says your business is being run as a flat book. That wasn't happening. It was, you know, because you don't make money being, you know, perfectly hedged, right? So there's risk in all of these things that we were doing. And this, depending on what we were doing, right? In options books, right? We were long volatility in some books. We were short volatility in other books. And they were hedged to a point, but you got to have some open risk there in order to be able to get a spread out of it in some ways, right? And so in each of these, we could take a look. And, you know, even in the commodity business, right, where it was really we were hedging into the futures exchanges and we were rolling the exchanges, you're at risk to that roll because you have to expect that the roll is going to either be in contango or backwardation, and you need to make sure that which is commodity terms for either a positive yield curve or a negative yield curve. It was in the
article. I said the Harper's article that's, wasn't detailed enough, but I would never have known those terms except
right,
for reading that
right,
last
right.
Week.
Well, that's how you make money in it, is those two things, right, and how it works. So this book, and again, then you know, you say, well, it was a long-only book and you didn't hedge it. I look at it and I say, wait a second, though. Look at the structural supports we built in. That is the equivalent of a hedge. If you put on a transaction and you have a 37% buffer, and, you know, again, we today have not gone through 37% losses in the housing market here, right? We haven't seen, you know, and
in ECDs, to the best of our knowledge.
Well, no, I mean in the U.S. housing
oh,
market,
in
the subprime
oh, no,
housing
wrong.
Market. Let's, you know, just, right, we're talking about massive issues in the U.S. housing market, but we're not talking about anywhere near those kinds of levels of losses coming, and on an accumulated basis, too, right? So I think you need to look at this business and just think about it as a, you know, that the subordination piece is a structural short against the long that you're at risk and that you really do have a bit of a hedge. Now, you know, this is me, and this is the business I did, and that's what I'm telling you. You can go away and think about it how you want, right? But...
And hindsight's 2020.
Well, so far, I'll come back to my maiden lane three. The hindsight's telling me we're okay.
Right.
Right.
So my only other, the only other question that I have is whether FP experienced any other issues or problems with any other types of derivatives. Obviously, we've focused on the credit derivatives book and specifically the multi-sector book today, and that's what everybody knows about. But Our mandate is much broader than just credit derivatives, and would be interested in having you speak to FP's experience with its other derivatives books and whether there are problems there.
Could I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
I've never asked him that question before.
Mm-hmm.
Can we have a conversation about that and then maybe get back to you after today with an answer to that?
Why?
Would that be?
I mean, is it a really sensitive sort of subject?
No, probably not, but no lawyer wants to have your answer.
I mean,
well, then we can just take a break.
Well, or I was going to say, answer it and get back to us with a supplemental answer.
No. You, no defense lawyer wants to hear the answer to a question the very first time. It's also, let's take a break. If it's really important to you, we'll take a break. I don't know the answer to the question.
Before we do that, this whole crisis and what went on with the multi-sector CDO world has created a new definition for problems. So, you know, nothing, you know, like this. You know, we, you know, look, there, you know, occasionally, you know, we had inputs wrong in something. We, you know, but what we always would do, we'd correct for our errors as you grew along if there were, but there was nothing of any severe magnitude. There's nothing that I think I can tell you that would... from my experience at FP that said, look, you guys should be looking over here too, right? Or, you know, you should advise the commissioners that I think there's an issue over here in this part of the world. And, you know, I could be blind right now to all the things that we're talking about and maybe missing it or something, but there's nothing that's jumping out at me that's saying, look, you guys, I understand all the time and effort you're putting over here, but go look over here too. There's nothing like that, that, in my experience at least, that I would point to. And I think that's okay.
I just had two follow-up conversation questions. You mentioned that you lost your deferred 07, but just so we don't get our facts wrong, did you in fact make $9 million in consulting fees in 2008?
No.
Okay.
I made, I think I made $6 million. And when the company got taken over, by the government, you know.
What was that? Because you didn't start until...
It's April, too.
April, May, June, July.
I think I got my last
payment
in September, right?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway, and so, and then we suspended the payment. So, you know, I said, look.
Okay. So it's give or take $6 million.
It's six, I think almost certainly $6 million.
And you mentioned earlier that you were doing some advising to Mr. Dooley and others.
And under the consulting agreement.
Under the consulting agreement. How much work were you doing? What were you doing?
In the beginning, you know, taking, I traveled with Bill to all the offices, so, you know, obviously Tokyo, Hong Kong, you know, Wilton, Paris, London, right? Introduced Bill to all the people in the company. Also introduced the company generally to Bill. Worked with my colleagues about the continuity of the company and understanding that there's going to be a continuity here and that, you know, irrespective of what's happening to me or that my retirement look is the company, you know, AIG wants the company to succeed and we're here and they're working towards that. Then spent time with Bill and Elias and whoever Bill would ask that, you know, about here's what these reports are, here's what these are the things I look at, here's how we go about the business, sort of advising him generally about the general management of the business. People would come to me with things that were in train, right, and say, well, what do I do? You know, gee, I was working on this, now what? And I'd get Bill and them on the phone together and talk about where we were, what these discussions were, where it was going. So that lasted pretty much up to June, but it was a bit of a declining thing, right, because you become a bit of a lame duck in a way, right, through June.
Did Julie, by the way, relocate to London to run the business?
No.
Right, so this is at a time where the head of the business is over in New York for probably good and substantial reasons, and there's no one there mining the ship.
Right, and also, right, and actually, it's a good point. That was the other thing, is just making sure that Bill was aware of anything that was going on. You know, just make sure what people were doing and all that. And then over time, you know, the role began to not, there wasn't much, you know, I was in the office all the time, but, you know, then Bill decided at some point, I think it was in July, and Bill said, look, you know, appreciate everything you're doing, but, you know, it's probably good if you just work from home now under the consulting agreement, and, you know, if we need you, we'll call you, and, you know, and if we need to, you can come in and stuff. And that was fine. And so I think from July, August, from July, I was working from home.
Thank you. Do you have any recollection?
Probably at this point, no.
just one question.
No, it's fine.
The Office of Thrift Supervision, as a consolidated group-wide supervisor of AIG, I understand that they did a few visitations at AIG FP.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any recollection in the 06, 07 time frame if they had material conclusions that were brought to your attention regarding the condition of FP, the safety and soundness condition at FP?
Yeah, they spent a lot of time in our offices, and I would have, what are they called, exit meetings or whatever,
sure,
right, where they would sit and go through that. But, you know, there was, you know, you have files of that, you know what it was and things, but it was nothing that was jumping out and saying, you know, it was, you know, there were things they always, who was it? Was it Ben or was it the bank regulators in France? There was one issue about calculating, you know, future exposure on the rest of the derivative book, right, that people wanted us to work on, and we would, but we were willing to do it, and we had other projects, and I would explain that to him, that we were getting through, and here's where it is in the queue, and that kind of thing. But I think there's a record of all of that, but my recollection is that I know I had those meetings. I know they were in and reviewing things. I also know that the Commission Bancaire was in our offices in Connecticut reviewing the business, because we were using the Connecticut office as, think about it as a bit of an outsource for some of the systems work that we were doing for the bank itself, right? And they were in our offices in London and Paris and doing reviews, and we'd have exit interviews with them about the business. And so, you know, it's one of the things when people talk about regulation, that, you know, it was a good part of the business. It was highly regulated because it was done in the bank.
Last question, question we ask everybody at the end.
Anything else you want to say?
Actually, no, but maybe second to last question.
See, you just got yourself another question.
But when you look back now, I mean, we ask everybody this, mistakes made, lessons learned, you know, what were the mistakes made at AIG? It obviously went down in flames and cost a lot of taxpayer money.
Are you asking about AIG in general or FP specifically?
I'm asking both. Actually, and I suspect you have more insight on FP than you do on AIG overall, but I'd love to hear your answer on both to the extent you can.
You know, Chris, I don't know, right? This is the thing that gets me, is that I'm not sure what happened after I was no longer the CEO, right? You know, as we talked about, you know, I was in this other role, right? I'm not sure why things ended up the way they are, why they did. Why did the rating agencies decide to downgrade the company in September so severely? What was it that caused the liquidity crisis? What was it they were looking at in the other bits of the company at the time, right? Because, you know, and you know, I sort of feel like a, you know, I'm, you know, you work through one of these issues and you can solve them all. And frankly, I'm not sure. So it's a little hard for me to piece it all together at the end of the day.
Okay, so then this will be the last question. Anything else you want to say?
Well, I have just a question for you guys. So what happens Wednesday? What is Wednesday? Is that the 30th?
Okay. I'm happy to answer that, but I don't think we need on the tape.
Yeah, but let me say something in closing, and then we can go off. I'll go offline and just talk about next steps. First of all, thank you very much. You guys, obviously, wow. My God, from the first time that I talked to you, you guys have really done an incredible amount of learning, and your questions were great, and the tone was so productive. And I hope that at the end of this, regardless of what your view is, you acknowledge and appreciate that Joe really tried his best, even in this interview, to be as diligent and directly answer your questions and not just give you a lot of fluff.
Fine. I didn't know you were finished.
No, I'm not finished. I was just hoping that you would say, yes, you agree with that.
We thank Mr. Cassano and you for coming in.
Secondly, to the extent that
Volunteering to come in.
To the extent that you guys are encouraging or asking the commissioners to ask about the risk management of the super senior portfolio, I cannot stress this enough that I am absolutely confident that eventually, if what comes out of this is questions about risk management, that people will look at Maiden Lane 3 and figure out whether the super senior triggers have been tripped. And if they have not, come to the conclusion that I think we've come to based on the information that we have, which is that American taxpayer would have been better off keeping the $40 billion that was FP's portion of it and holding on to the CDS contracts because the super senior triggers have not been tripped. And so fundamentally, a lot of this interview was about risk management at FP. And I cannot see how that gets anyone anywhere in terms of an answer to the financial crisis if I'm right. And maybe I'm not right. And maybe some super senior trigger has been tripped. But even if it happened on one deal or two deals, it still would be better to hold the CDS on the rest of the portfolio, pay off, you know, $1 billion and keep 40 in your pocket. So I hope that by the time that Wednesday come, we can all get more clarity on whether or not it is in fact true that these products performed under the underwriting standards, performed as they were intended to perform, because I think that that is a hugely important conclusion if that's true in terms of the way that the bailout was handled. But finally, I'll say, and Donna, this goes to your questions, and I've said this to you guys before, and I'm going to say it again without trying not to sound preachy. When you really look at all the facts and you listen to this man, right, and you see the number of CEOs that basically duck and run for cover, and even in the middle of crisis, they're out on a yacht or they're out on, they're out on the golf course or wherever, and this guy was in the office rolling up his sleeves trying to lead his team to the right answer day after day after day. And then you see what happened to him when, for some reason, even though FP's part of the bailout was significantly less than half, suddenly his name gets leaked, and he's the one that is patient zero of the financial crisis, right? For contracts that are still, as far as I'm concerned, money good today, you can imagine that the fact that he can come here to a government agency and just call it like it is hard. He's been vilified. And so particularly on questions when it comes to the consulting agreement, you have to know Sullivan's already testified it was his idea. They told Waxman's committee that, right? He stayed on. He was the one that basically said at the end of the day, if you're not going to use me, I won't take the payments anymore. How many CEOs do that? How many CEOs volunteer not to take any money before anyone says word one to them? I hope that in prepping the commissioners, you will make those things clear to them so that we, because I can guarantee you that any unfair shot that is taken against him is going to further make it impossible for him to, now that we've cleared the SEC and DOJ, to do something productive, which I think he deserves to do. Thank you for
Mr. Cassano, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
And look, I have a lot of respect for what you guys are doing, too, and I recognize the challenge. you know, I can't imagine what it's like to sort of sort through everything the way you're trying to do it. And not just with us, I mean the whole financial crisis and, you know, so. And I, you know, I gather your audience is the commissioners at the end of the day. So what is Wednesday?
All right, so.